Welcome to Off the Shelf, Festival of Words, brought to you by the University of Sheffield. In this episode, part of our Ideas Alive series, Michael Jacobs, Professorial Fellow in Sheffield Political Economy Research Institute, discusses ways in which new thinking about the economy and economic policy can help address the multiple crises we face.
The title of this talk is Rethinking Capitalism. My starting place is a series of crises that Western economies, economies which are capitalist in form, have experienced over the last decade or so. Today, we're obviously all conscious of the crisis caused by the coronavirus, but this has come on top of three other major kinds of crisis in recent years. The financial crisis, manifested in the Great Crash of 2008 and its long aftermath, a crisis of rising inequality, and the destabilising political consequences which have apparently flowed from it, such as the votes for Brexit and Donald Trump, and a crisis of climate change and environmental breakdown, which we can now see all around us. We have, in effect, been living in a period of more or less constant crisis over the last decade, and this is surely an indication that capitalism is not performing well, and hence why we might wish to rethink it. By rethinking capitalism, I have in mind two different meanings of the term. One, examining how capitalism works, its structures and dynamics, and how these might be changed, notably to address the crises we've experienced. Two, I want to discuss the ideas through which we think about capitalism and through which its current form has been explained and justified. I shall argue that many of these ideas, mostly drawn from the discipline of economics, themselves don't work very well anymore. This is obviously a large and complex subject, so I want to organise it in what I hope is a fairly simple way. I'm going to take the three major crises of the last decade and try and describe how each has arisen from the form that contemporary capitalism has come to take. Then I want to go through each again and discuss the ideas that underpin them and why they need rethinking too. I'll conclude with some reflections on what it would mean politically to rethink capitalism. One issue is worth dealing with before I begin. There isn't a single version of capitalism. There are different types in different countries and different periods. As technologies advance, social structures develop and trade patterns shift, capitalism changes. It has general features. It's a system where the ownership of capital is largely in private hands, where investment and employment are determined principally by decisions made by businesses seeking profit, and in which the banking system creates money through lending. But all this can and does take different forms in different places and times. In particular, different kinds of capitalism can involve a larger or smaller role for the state and for the public and social sectors. The way capitalism works in Germany or Scandinavia is not the same as in the US or UK, and in Japan or South Korea, it's different again. The crises I'm going to discuss have been experienced by more or less all forms of Western capitalism over the past decade or so, but it is also true to say that they've been particularly stark in the US and the UK, which share an Anglo-American model. So I shall be talking particularly about this, and especially the British version of it. So let's start with the financial crisis. The Great Crash of 2008, which almost collapsed the global economy, wasn't the only major financial crisis of recent years. You may recall the dot-com bubble and the Asian financial crisis, which both occurred in the 1990s. In fact, there have been a whole series of banking and related crises in different countries over the last 40 years, many more than in the period before. The big change occurred after the financial sector was liberalised in the 1980s, given much more licence to lend, to allow capital to cross borders and to create new types of assets. Liberalisation, was known as the so-called Big Bang, was carried out initially in the UK and US by Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and then more or less everywhere else in the Western world. Since then, the financial sector has grown hugely in size and has become global in scope. Banks, investment managers, pension funds and other financial companies continue to serve the rest of the economy, lending to businesses, providing pensions and mortgages and so on. But an increasing proportion of what the financial sector does has come largely to serve itself, raising the profits of the sector and the values of the assets it creates. Measured as a proportion of national income, debt of both companies and households has increased dramatically over the last 40 years. Equity prices, the prices of company shares, have seen long booms. But almost inevitably, financial volatility has followed as the financial sector invests in certain kinds of assets, technology companies, subprime mortgages, sovereign bonds, packages them up and trades them widely, before it is realised that they're not worth what they were thought, and a crash occurs. Financial instability, boom and bust, is one consequence. But another, perhaps even more serious, is the impact on investment in the rest of the real economy. Fiercely competitive, the financial sector has sought to make increasingly short-term profits for its asset owners. For companies making and selling goods and services, this has led to a demand to return more of these profits to their shareholders. Dividend payments have risen, and companies have increasingly bought back their own shares in order to keep the price up. The result, inevitably, is that less money has been available for long-term investment, which is what drives innovation and generates real wealth. And so over the last 20 years or so, we've seen a consistent decline in investment rates as a proportion of company profits and of national income. This has in turn contributed to a slowdown in productivity, which has been more or less stagnant ever since the financial crash, and in turn in wages. These trends constitute the phenomenon known as financialization. The increasing scale of the financial sector in relation to the rest of the economy and the widening influence of financial imperatives in the way that companies and other areas of society operate and make decisions. In the UK, they've had a further effect of keeping the pound overvalued as the City of London has attracted capital flows from overseas. This in turn has made it harder for manufacturers and others to export, so weakening our wider economic performance. The City is a big employer and it's an earner of export revenues in itself, but there are good grounds to say that it has now grown too big for the health of the economy overall. So many would argue that the financialisation of capitalism over recent decades needs to be rethought. The scale of the financial sector and the influence of its drive for short-term profits needs to be reined back. The financial sector needs to be placed under more regulatory control, required to focus on supporting the rest of the economy rather than itself, and its activities constrained to dampen its tendency to crisis and instability. Financialization of capitalism in recent decades has also contributed to the second of the crises I want to discuss, that of rising inequality. Over the past 30 to 40 years, almost all developed economies have seen a widening gap between the richest and poorest groups in society, particularly between the very rich, the top 1%, and the bottom fifth. Between 1979 and 2012 in the UK, fully 40% of the overall growth in national income we had in that period went to the richest 10% of the population, while the bottom 50% of people gained only 10% of it. The bottom third got practically nothing. In the US, the figures are even starker. Though various measures, such as the minimum wage and child benefits, slowed the growth of income inequality in the first decade of the century, and the financial crash did briefly cause a hit to top incomes and wealth, a powerful long-term trend has occurred across almost all capitalist economies over the last 40 years. This is the reduction in the proportion of national income which has gone to wages and salaries, and an increase in the proportion which has been returned to the owners of wealth. In the UK, the Bank of England estimates that the so-called labour share of national income has declined from around 70% to just 55% since the mid-1970s. There are two dynamics in contemporary capitalism which have resulted in this phenomenon. One is to do with wealth, the other with work. Partly as a result of the financialisation we've discussed, the returns which people get from owning financial assets, such as stocks and shares and land and property, have consistently exceeded the growth of the economy as a whole and of earnings from work. People who own wealth have become richer at a much faster rate than people who only work for a living. The small minority, the 1%, who own a lot of wealth, have become vastly richer. But this widening of inequality has become intergenerational too. As land and house prices have increased, fueled by investment and speculation by the financial sector, a growing gap has emerged between older people who were able to buy their own homes in the past and their children, who have no hope of doing so. At the same time as inequality of wealth has increased, so has inequality in work. If you have scarce skills and bargaining power in the labour market, you can command a good salary, which rises over time. But millions of people today cannot do that and have seen their wages stagnate as a result. Remarkably, average earnings in the UK today are barely higher than they were before the financial crash. Perhaps most obviously, work has become much more insecure over this period. There's been a significant increase in the proportion of work which is part-time and of the numbers of self-employed, now 15% of the UK labour force. A large so-called gig economy of irregular hours has grown up, with nearly a million people in the UK working before the present crisis on 0 hours contracts. Of course, such flexible arrangements work well for some, But for many others, they bring just insecurity, with few rights to benefits such as sick pay and fluctuating incomes that make household budgeting very hard. Overall, the ease with which employers can now hire an extra hour of labour rather than invest in equipment or skills is one of the reasons why productivity has not grown. Over the last decade, economists have been surprised that we've had something close to full employment, but wages haven't risen. But we can find part of the answer in this increasing casualisation of work, which has made it hard or impossible for many workers to bargain for higher wages. In turn, this has led over the last decade to the phenomenon, possibly for the first time ever, of economic growth, which has not been accompanied by rising average earnings. And the growing disparities of wealth and income are not the only inequalities we see. Despite progress in some professions, employment patterns today remain highly stratified between men and women, and the gender pay gap persistently high. Educational and economic opportunities are systematically worse for people of working class and ethnic minority backgrounds. And the UK is one of the most geographically unequal economies in Europe, with economic growth over the last few decades disproportionately concentrated in London and the South East, leading to widening disparities with the other regions and nations of the UK. Some areas which suffered most from the deindustrialisation of the 1980s have never properly recovered. It's too simple to say that the growth of job insecurity, regional disparities, and rising awareness of social inequalities have been responsible for the increase in political populism, which many countries have seen over the last decade, manifested most obviously in the votes for Brexit and Trump. There have been many causes, and every country is different. But equally, there's good reason to believe that they have contributed to the political disaffection and loss of trust in established institutions, which is now well documented, and which underlies much of the political instability and conflict of recent years. So if we are to address these issues, we need to rethink the way in which contemporary capitalism is structured. In particular, we need to address the ownership of wealth and capital, finding ways of distributing financial assets and housing much more widely and fairly amongst the population, so that all can gain from its higher returns. We need to rethink how the labour market is organised, protecting workers by better regulating insecure forms of work and giving them greater bargaining power, for example, by strengthening the role of trade unions. We need to take active steps to reduce the systemic inequalities of gender, race and class, and to spread investment and job creation more equally across the nations and regions of the UK. The third crisis is that of climate change and environmental breakdown. This has been building for a long time. In recent years, most people have become at least somewhat aware of the scale of climate change. Unless we drastically and rapidly reduce the use of fossil fuels for energy, transport and industry, and the management of land, particularly forests and peatlands, the world is heading for 3 degrees of global heating, and possibly more. And this will have catastrophic consequences. In extreme weather events such as floods, hurricanes and forest fires, and for food production, human livelihoods and nature. But the wider environmental crisis is even more profound. In a whole range of areas, the global economy is exceeding the planetary boundaries which scientists have identified as providing the space in which humanity can safely survive. The depletion of fertile soils, the destruction of fish stocks, habitats and biodiversity, and the extinction of species, the acidification and pollution of the oceans, the disruption to geochemical cycles, all these indicate an economic system which is close to breaching the tipping points where environmental damage is not just unsustainable, but irreversible. The ecological and human consequences are already severe. What is it in capitalism that causes such impacts? It is unfortunately capitalism's core dynamic, its central engine, the drive to growth and the accumulation of capital. But it is not only this. In itself, capitalism's core dynamic is the growth of value, of profit and income. That's what the owners of capital are seeking. Mostly it's what we all want. What makes this drive lead to the over-extraction and destruction of resources and the pollution of air, water and land is the lack of environmental constraint that our economies have placed on it. We, societies, have allowed economic growth to take almost no account of its ecological consequences. Of course, we've enacted environmental legislation, which limits some impacts, and importantly so. But overall, at the level of the global economy and global impacts, economic growth has been more or less entirely environmentally unconstrained. By act of omission, by not limiting the overall ecological impacts of their production and consumption activity, capitalist economies, and non-capitalist ones too, of course, have undermined their very foundations. There is only one way that this can be changed. We have to make the Earth's environmental limits, its ability to sustain the provision of resources over time, to provide rich and healthy natural systems, we have to make these absolute constraints on economic activity. That is, we have to make sustainability the priority, and to constrain the drive to economic growth, with laws, regulations, taxes, planning mechanisms, innovation, changes in lifestyles and consumption patterns, with all the tools at our disposal, where economic growth would conflict with sustainability. And we need to do this on a global scale. So this is where we need to turn to the ideas that are used to justify capitalism and legitimise the way it works. I want to reverse the order I deal with these here and start with the idea of economic growth, since it is so central to our environmental predicament. And in particular, it's the idea which has dominated economic and political thought for almost a century, that economic growth is the definition and measure of economic progress. It's not hard to see why this idea came to be so powerful. Economic growth raises standards of living, takes people out of poverty, creates jobs, and it funds public services and public goods. It's helped make societies more scientifically and technologically advanced, enabled diseases to be conquered, the arts and culture to advance, and societies to become more liberal. What's not to like? Well, climate change and environmental breakdown are clearly not to like. Today, it's impossible to ignore the way in which growth is generated and its destructive and dangerous impact on the natural world. So we have to temper the idea of growth as progress. It's only progress if it is ecologically healthy and environmentally sustainable. Sustainability is a prior goal and measure of economic success. But the critique of growth is wider than this. Rising incomes are a good thing, critically for those with least. They are vital to reduce and eliminate poverty. But higher income does not capture and cannot provide many of the things which make for a flourishing life and a good society. People are happy not only when they have money, but when they have good and satisfying work, when their physical and mental health is good, when they have time to love and care for their families and to contribute to their communities, when they can enjoy public services and public goods that can only be provided collectively, such as clean air and green spaces, safe and livable towns and cities, a sense of social cohesion. We know that more equal societies are happier ones for everyone. So these things too, which together make up our well-being, both as individuals and as societies, these are the things we need to pay attention to when defining and measuring progress. Economic growth can contribute to them, but it's clear that many of the ways we generate growth today do the opposite. They detract from our well-being. So we need to go beyond growth as our measure of economic progress. Rethinking capitalism means redefining the purpose of our economies. Environmental sustainability, improving well-being, reducing inequalities, and in the light of the financial and COVID crisis, strengthening the resilience of economic systems. These need to become the goals of economic policy and the measures of an economy's success. But reflecting on how societies need to constrain and modify the growth imperative reveals another key idea through which we need to rethink capitalism. In the past, and still, we've treated the environmental impacts of economic activity as an afterthought of policymaking. We allow the economy to determine investment, production, and consumption patterns. Then we discover the environmental impacts these unfortunately have, and then we try to reduce them. It's a kind of sticking plaster approach, dealing with the problems only after the fact, not looking to their causes and preventing them occurring in the first place. And it's no longer tenable. We have to build environmental sustainability in from the beginning, in the way economic decisions are made. And this idea applies also when we consider how to reduce inequalities. For the last 40 years or so, two types of approach have dominated thinking in economic policy about how to deal with inequality. On the one hand, governments have sought to improve equality of opportunity, believing that everyone should in principle have the same rights to education, to skills training, and to job opportunities. They've sought to improve the access of lower income and disadvantaged groups to these things and to counter overt discrimination. On the other, they've used the tax and benefit system, some governments more than others, it has to be said, to enact a measure of redistribution, taking some income away from the rich and providing it to those lower down the income scale. But these methods, while important, have not prevented inequality from rising. And the reason is that the dynamics in capitalism which are responsible for many of these inequalities are now embedded in the core structures of the economy, as we've seen in the ownership and returns to wealth and capital assets, and in the way work is organised. It's not enough anymore to give people a little more equality of opportunity as they enter the economy and then redistribute a little bit afterwards. We will only properly address inequalities now if we change some of the economy's core structures, the ways in which contemporary capitalism works. Like sustainability, we have to hardwire greater equality into the system, not treat it as an afterthought. Indeed, that's true too of our other goals, of improving well-being and of making the economy more resilient. They need to be built in. How can this be done? Well, this takes us to the core idea which has justified the financialisation of the economy and some of its associated trends over the last 40 years. That idea was that so-called free markets, in which private sector actors are relatively unconstrained in the decisions they make about investment and production, are essentially efficient. And efficient markets generate the best economic outcomes. This was particularly thought to be true in the financial sector, before the 2008 financial crash proved it rather spectacularly not to be the case. But it was much more widely applied too. The best approach to economic policy, has been generally thought, is to allow the private sector to decide and to remove regulations which constrain its market behaviour wherever possible. If an economy is not efficient after all, it's wasting resources, which could be better deployed to make everyone, at least in principle, better off. It's a powerful idea drawn from an important body of so-called neoclassical economic theory, but it is deeply flawed. Markets are not always efficient and do not always allocate resources in optimal ways. Markets fail. Of course, this in itself has long been accepted, both in neoclassical economics and in policy making. Where there are externalities, such as pollution, or where public goods need to be provided, such as scientific research and defence, it's well understood that markets don't allocate efficiently, and governments need to step in to correct such failures. But the problem goes much deeper than this. The assumption here is that market failures are relatively small and can be corrected largely by marginal microeconomic interventions, by environmental taxation, for example, or by a measure of public spending. That is sometimes possible. But many market failures are not small. They are systemic and pervasive. Financial instability is not a minor market failure. It's built into the ways in which the financial sector has come to be structured in contemporary capitalism. Short-termism in business investment is now an inevitable outcome of shareholder-based corporate governance and the dominance of investment funds in stock markets. Rising land and property prices inescapably follow from the way in which real estate has become an investment class in deregulated financial markets. Climate change is not an incidental product of the misallocation of resources in an otherwise efficient market. It is built into an economic system based on carbon. How can we rethink the dominant idea that free markets and decision-making by private interests generate the best economic outcomes? It's not to throw out the idea of markets or private companies altogether. There are huge advantages to both. But it is to say that most important outcomes cannot simply be determined by private actors in deregulated markets. When market failures are so pervasive, society as a whole needs a say. That means, in practice, elected governments, as only elected governments have the legitimacy and the power to affect the way the economy works and the outcomes it generates. They can not only regulate markets, they can shape them, for example, through an active approach to industrial policy. It's not easy for governments to do this. They can get it wrong too. But the balance between the freedom of private corporations and markets and the role of governments to shape the outcomes which will benefit society as a whole needs to be struck in a new way. So these then are the core ideas with which I believe we need to rethink capitalism if we are to deal with the continuing crisis with which it has confronted us. We need to go beyond growth as the definition and measure of economic progress and prioritise instead environmental sustainability, improving well-being, reducing inequalities and strengthening system resilience. To do this, we need to change the structure and dynamics of capitalism which lead to the problems we now face, building the achievement of these goals into the ways the economic system works, not making the afterthoughts of policy. And to do this, we need to re-establish the critical role of elected governments on behalf of people to determine the outcomes of our economic system and economic life, shaping markets for public purposes and constraining the power of private interests within them. Can capitalism be rethought in these ways, both in the ideas which underpin it and in the structures and dynamics through which it works? Well, something like this has happened before. Twice, in fact, in the last century, what social scientists call a paradigm shift occurred. First in the ideas through which capitalist economies were understood to work, and then in their structures, as policies based on those ideas were implemented by governments. In the 1920s, the economic orthodoxy in theory and policy was laissez-faire. But after the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression, these ideas proved unable either to explain or to solve the problem of mass unemployment and deficient demand. John Maynard Keynes proposed a different set of ideas. And in due course, the old paradigm was replaced by what we now know as Keynesianism, the post-war policy regime of full employment, public ownership, and the welfare state. The form that capitalism took underwent a fundamental change. Keynesianism became the new orthodoxy, accepted by both sides of the political spectrum, and it underpinned economic and social policy for around 30 years. But the multiple crises of the 1970s, the oil price shock, and the simultaneous occurrence of inflation and unemployment seemed to undermine Keynesian theory. So in the 1980s, with the election of Thatcher and Reagan, a second paradigm shift occurred. Keynesianism was replaced by a new orthodoxy, that of free market neoliberalism, with its agenda of deregulation, privatisation, and market liberalisation. This too was accepted, more or less, right across the political spectrum. And again, the character of capitalism was changed. This model has now lasted for around 40 years. Today, the time seems to be ripe for another paradigm shift of these kinds, in which the dominant ideas that underpin economic policymaking are changed, and this leads to fundamental policy reform. Just as in the 1930s and 1970s, modern capitalist economies are today generating multiple crises of financial instability, rising inequality and loss of political legitimacy, and climate and environmental breakdown. To address them, we need to change the structures and dynamics, the way our economies work. To do that, we need to replace the thinking that has been dominant for a long time. One final question perhaps remains. If we really did this, if we changed capitalism in these fundamental ways, would it still be capitalism? Are we really talking about reform of the economic system, albeit a fundamental one? Or can these multiple crises only really be addressed by replacing the system altogether? My answer to this is that we don't really know. There's never been a form of capitalism which is environmentally sustainable, and it might not be possible. Seriously addressing the dynamics of inequality requires changing the ownership of wealth and of companies and the mechanisms of the financial system in such a way as to raise a legitimate query as to whether the term capitalism would still be appropriate. But in a sense, this question becomes mainly semantic, about how we define capitalism and its possible alternatives. In practice, the more significant question is how we would create the political conditions under which the process of radical reform could start and could gain public support sufficient to overcome those who would oppose it. In this process, it matters less whether reform or replacement is considered to be the ultimate destination. Supporters of each will share the same initial goals. It's starting the journey that's surely the most important thing. If you'd like to read any more about this subject, I've written about it in a number of places. One is a book called Rethinking Capitalism, which I edited with the economist Mariana Mazzucato, published by Wiley-Blackwell. It's a collection of essays by leading economists showing how orthodox economic thinking does a poor job of understanding modern economies and how better thinking can lead to better policy making. A second publication is the report of the IPPR Commission on Economic Justice, which I was the director. The commission was a two-year inquiry into the UK economy. Its final report, Prosperity and Justice, analyses why the economy has been failing badly and provides over 70 recommendations for radical policy reform. It's available as a book published by Polity, or you can read it online on the IPPR website, ippr.org/CEJ. I also have a new paper, shortly to be published by the OECD, entitled Beyond Growth, Towards a New Economic Approach. That will be available on the OECD website, oecd.org. Search for their pages on new approaches to economic challenges.
Thank you for listening. We'll be publishing content throughout the festival. For more information, visit offtheshelf.org.uk. Find us on Twitter at OTSFestival and at facebook.com/offtheshelf.